wait until the courtroom clears. All right, Mr. Hellman, good morning.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Morpho incurred millions of dollars of unanticipated taxes of performing work for the government. But the government now claims it has no obligation to reimburse Morpho for these taxes. That is precisely the type of unfairness that the after-imposed tax clause is designed and intended to prevent. And I'd like to begin this morning with our argument that the Washington state tax is at minimum ambiguous, because that's an argument on which there's actually relatively little disputed between the two parties. Neither OJRA nor TSA has ever contested that the imposition of an ambiguous tax is an after-imposed tax within the meaning of the clause in question. And TSA's primary argument on appeal is not that the tax is clear, but that Morpho waived an argument that it wasn't. But there is no waiver here. And if this court agrees that the Washington tax is ambiguous, as it surely is, then this court must reverse and remand. So I'd like to begin just at the outset with the waiver argument that the government makes. Our argument is, and always has been, that the Washington tax does not clearly apply to work performed on non-federal property. We presented this argument to WASHDOR, the Department of Revenue of Washington, and to OJRA. And I'd point the court to JA-54, in which OJRA, in its decision, quotes us as making this very argument to WASHDOR and then rejects it on the merits. So you have a situation in which OJRA itself recognized we made this argument and it's dealt with on the merits. So I don't believe there's any fair ground for arguing waiver in this case. Which takes us to the merits question. Is the Washington state tax ambiguous? And we believe it clearly is. This tax has been on the books for 30 years and has never been applied to a federal contractor performing work not on federal land. As we explain in our brief, there's a quite scholarly Supreme Court opinion on the U.S. Supreme Court opinion on the origins of this tax, which explains in detail that the very purpose of the tax was to close a loophole, I suppose, in Washington state tax law, which is that Washington normally taxes the landowner of property when services are performed, but it couldn't do that when the United States is the landowner because of the supremacy clause. So faced with that problem, Washington enacted the tax in question here, which says that where the federal government is the landowner, then the tax falls on the contractor, not the landowner. And you see that in the plain text of the tax provision.
It says of or for the United States.
Correct. It says real property of or for the United States.
What do you think for the United States means?
Well, real property for the United States is a somewhat, I would say, inherently ambiguous term. If we're going to give it separate meaning, which I'm not sure is even required, I mean, there's plenty of dyads in the law, null and void, free and clear, of or for. Where there's no separate meaning given to either term.
Over four,
a little different.
Okay, over four may be different. But the question is, what? And again, this goes to the ambiguity that we're talking about here. The tax does not say performing services for the United States. The tax says performing services on real property of or for the United States. If the for were clearly referring to the work itself as opposed to the property, there would be commas, it would be in a different place in the statute. There's any number of ways that expression could be signified, but at best, of or for does not clearly and never has been once in the 30 years of this statute ever applied to someone merely doing work for the United States, regardless of where that work takes place. And I suppose, to back up for one second, the purpose of the after-imposed tax clause is designed to solve a certain problem at the time of contracting. I'm going to perform work for the government. How should I price in a fixed price contract the work that I'm going to do? Neither the government nor the contractor wants to have to put in contingencies for uncertain interpretations of law or new interpretations of law. If you did that, then we'd have to price into our contract, well, this could come out this way, this could come out this way, and all of a sudden the contract becomes more expensive. And there's an elegant solution to that problem, which is the after-imposed tax clause, where there's a contingency that cannot be easily priced into the contract, such as the contingency that for the first time in 30 years this statute would be interpreted to apply to work done on non-federal property. Then the after-imposed tax clause says, don't try to price that into the contract. And instead, if that contingency arises, then the United States will reimburse.
This must be a common provision in contracts, and it strikes me as something that must lead to a lot of problems given the way state taxes work. Is that...
Well, you know, I had the same thought, Your Honor. You know, one interesting aspect of this is we're under the AMS clause here, which really governs a relatively narrow band of government contracting. Mm-hmm. The FAR, the Federal Acquisition Regulations, have the same clause, but only apply to federal taxes that are imposed after imposed. Mm-hmm. So I suppose this doesn't come up that often just because there just aren't that many cases under it. But I would point the court to,
Here everyone was aware that state taxes were a possibility.
Well, of course, we didn't know the extent to which we'd be performing in any state.
Right.
But a possibility is exactly what the after-imposed tax clause is. If it's reasonable, if one reasonably thinks that the tax may not be imposed, then the idea is that you shouldn't try to price that into the contract because that only ends up increasing the cost of the contract. And I point the
court. Well, I guess you could have made clear in the contract, though, right, that this kind of state tax possibility would not be your burden.
Well, that's exactly what the after-imposed clause tax does, Your Honor. It says that if something arises that we reasonably did not anticipate, mm-hmm. That burden goes to the government. And again, I want to be clear on this, that the United States itself, the contracting officer in this case, did not believe that there would be any taxes imposed of this nature. If I could point the court to JA 571, that's the declaration from the contracting officer in this case, which said, he said, because this property became owned by the United States before it ever got shipped anywhere, my assumption was there would be no contingent taxes. There were no contingencies. There would be no taxes that could arise. So everyone, TSA, Morpho, everyone agreed or was under the impression that there would be no Washington state tax here, or at most it was a contingency. And that is precisely the situation in which the tax should apply.
I'm having a hard time seeing why this is an after-imposed tax in
yes,
view of the language that defines an after-imposed tax as one that's been caused by legislative, executive, judicial, whatever determination.
Right.
I mean, if this hasn't been imposed in 30 years, it's been there for 30 years. I mean, there's been no change. So how do you get around that description of an after-imposed tax?
You know, I think if the regulation were getting at that idea, it would have just been legislative taxes. But where you say a judicial action or an administrative action, inherent in an adjudication is there's usually a tax on the books. And then the question is, does fruit now include tomatoes as opposed to just oranges and apples? And that type of judicial determination that says, now we read this tax to mean X and Y instead of just X, it must be what's contemplated here, because it talks about judicial determinations, all judicial determinations, any judicial determination, and likewise administrative determinations, which is what we had in this case.
Well, what's contemplated is some kind of reversal of state precedent, which you don't seem to have here. You have a tax that's on the books, which even you describe as ambiguous, which has never been imposed in a particular way.
Well, it would be, I would submit, an incredibly unfair and not consistent with the purpose of the clause to give it that meaning, because then if you had an ambiguous tax that had never been construed, and it never had been construed on this point, the contractor would just be out of luck. At that point, I suppose that rule would mean the contractor would have to say, every tax on the books that doesn't have a precedent directly on point against me is one that I need to somehow price into the tax. I just don't understand why that would be, a sensible way to try to arrange the affairs. It seems to me much more sensible and consistent with the notion of judicial changes or administrative changes to say that where one reasonably believes the tax does not apply, and there's really very little argument to the contrary, I know from TSA on this point, when one reasonably believes, and I don't see how there could be given its own contracting officer's statement that they didn't expect the tax, when one reasonably believes the tax does not apply, that's when the after-imposed tax is supposed to kick in. And the alternative, as I say, is that one would be forced to price all sorts of contingencies, which does not benefit the government in any way. If contractors would have to price those contingencies in, they're going to assume the worst in every situation. And as the authorities we cite in our brief, including the Cannon Structures case in our opening brief at page 29 say that's not the way that the clause or an analogous clause is supposed to work. And I see that I've almost used my time. I'd like to...
Let me ask you about this language that you started with, under upon, excuse me, or above real property.
Yes, Your Honor.
Of or for the United States. Now, normally, you don't talk about real property for the United States.
Right.
How would you, would it make any difference if it read under, upon, or above real property of the United States or for the United States? Would it make any
Of the United States or for the United States? It sounds a little bit like that.
In other words, real property of the United States or for the United States. Would that make any difference in your interpretation?
That would be a different statute, and I think closer to getting at the meaning that the government says is, argues is clear here. I believe that the way to understand the statute, which I would submit is ambiguous, is to look, we're talking about subsection 6 of the statute. If you look at subsection 4, which is immediately above it in the statutory appendix in our brief, it sets out the framework, and it says that the general rule is any person who is an owner, lessee, or has the right of possession to property, which is being constructed, repaired, et cetera, pays this tax unless that person is the United States. And that reflects the fact that Washington cannot tax the United States as a matter of constitutional law. So then you get to the exception or the fixing of that hole in the Washington tax structure, which is subsection 6, which is the provision that we've all been talking about here today. And that's where it says any person engaged in constructing, repairing buildings under, upon, or above real property of or for the United States. I think the for there is best read, and certainly fairly read, to capture the property interest described in part 4 above, in which the United States is excluded when it is the lessee or has the right of possession or easement. So for, of or for in that situation is fairly read to capture those different types of property interests. And again, that is the reading that makes, really the only reading that can be squared with the purpose of what the statute was intended to do. And if I could add one other
point. The Washington authorities obviously disagreed, although I guess you could say naturally.
I suppose naturally. And one more natural point here is that the real owner of this property is a municipal authority, the Port of Seattle. I believe that they are tax exempt under Washington state law as a matter of grace of Washington law. So Washington has chosen not to tax the Port of Seattle in running its airports, which is entirely its right to do so. But having done that, they can't then come and say, well, this is work for the United States, so we'll tax the contractor instead. If Washington wanted to tax the landowner, which it normally can do in this situation, it should tax the Port of Seattle. If it doesn't want to do that, it can't take this statute designed to be a tax, expressly designed to be a tax on real property of the United States, and shoehorn it into this situation. And at a minimum, again, we'd submit that all we need to do is show the tax is ambiguous, which for the reasons I've said, I believe it is.
All right, your time's up. We'll give you a minute or two.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Prouty.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Reed Prouty, the Department of Justice for the Transportation Security Administration. As your honors have divined, the case is really about whether a tax that has been on the books for more than 25 years constitutes an after-imposed tax for purposes of the after-imposed taxes clause. And the answer is it does not. Certainly, Mr. Hellman has expressed reasons why the government might want its policy to embrace the circumstances that are presented here. However, the after-imposed taxes clause is drawn much more narrowly than the policy that he'd like to have imposed would embrace. And that's mainly because that last clause, which makes very clear that as a result of legislative, judicial, or administrative action taking effect after the tax has been, after the contract, rather, has been signed. And there are many possible ways besides Mr. Helmut, Morfo, rather, I should say, has articulated that could be the case. For example, there could be an administrative interpretation at a lower level that says this tax does not apply, and that can be reversed. Likewise, a judicial interpretation saying this tax does not apply, have it reversed, or of course the legislative, where a brand new tax is passed. None of these happened here. At best, there is a first-time application of the tax, but there's really no evidence of that. The only evidence of how often this tax has been applied was the affidavit submitted by Morpho's tax attorney, who said, I've never seen a case about this.
Well, that, do you dispute that?
He's never seen a case about that? Not at all, Your Honor.
Do you dispute that there have been cases like this in Washington?
We don't know whether or not the tax has ever been imposed, or I should say whether or not it has ever been collected or assessed. Okay. The tax is on the books. Whether or not Washington ever assessed it, we don't know. What we do know is only that it has ever been challenged in court. That is the limit of the evidence that was presented by Morpho in its case before the ODRA. That was it, a very simple affidavit from its tax attorney. And it's interesting that Morpho makes the argument that the contracting officer didn't expect the taxes. Well, contracting officers are a lot of things, but they're not experts on state taxes. And certainly, one of the parts of the clause says that state and local taxes are assumed to be included in the contract price. And that's Section B of the clause. And the reason for that, as explained by ODRA, is that businesses are better at figuring out their tax liabilities than, in fact, contracting officers who are expert at a lot of things, but not state taxes. Morpho is a large corporation. It has tax counsel. It would know better than would the contracting officer what taxes are to be expected. And in fact, when they were asked to do the work of installing the machines in Washington State, they said, well, it's going to cost you this much, but we haven't included the Washington State sales tax of 8.8%. Shows that they certainly knew about Washington taxes at the point in 2003 when they were asked.
Doesn't it also show that even someone who's relatively attuned to this couldn't find from this language or from the precedents a likelihood that this kind of tax would be imposed?
Well, we don't know what efforts were taken by Morpho's counsel when it made its offer in 2003. We just don't know. What we do know, and there's just no evidence one way or the other, what we do know is if you open the law and you see consumer defined as somebody who they're going to take taxes from, it includes of or for the United States. And certainly Washington State is notorious, the Supreme Court cases and of course there's talk about it in the decision by ODRA of being aggressive towards taxing federal contractors.
What I think their argument is, what if the tax is on the books, it's never been applied before, and it's ambiguous as to whether it would apply to this situation?
Surely. Well, first of all, we would say that the evidence was it wasn't ambiguous.
But suppose it was.
Well, there would have to be, the ambiguity would have had to have been changed as a result of administrative action that took place after the contract was issued. That's, of course, what the AMS clause says. Now, I would suggest that...
That's what they say happened here. The ambiguity was altered by a determination in Washington that the tax did apply here, but that beforehand it was uncertain.
Correct. And the order said it was not uncertain. His decision, the judge's decision of fact that, no, there was this tax on the books, and no, it was not ambiguous. It was supported by substantial evidence because you had the Washtenaw decision saying, look, here's a tax, this is what we're going to determine. That was a factual determination whether or not there was a tax that was applicable. And that's supported by substantial evidence.
If it was ambiguous, and it's the ambiguity, as often happens, that's what decisions do administratively and judicial, is there's an ambiguous law and it's clarified over time. If it was ambiguous, and it's clarified after the contract here, your position is it tough because they should have anticipated the bad interpretation, or what's your...
I would say that if there's an interpretation that could have been drawn against Morpho, and it's clear that there's an ambiguous interpretation, gosh, this could hurt us, or gosh, this might not hurt us, they should protect themselves, just as any other business would if it was their money. Mm-hmm. Certainly if Morpho was doing business in Washington State for itself.
So that, I think your position is if there's an ambiguity, they lose, unless it's unambiguous.
If there is a clear risk that they're going to have the tax imposed upon them, and saying it's ambiguous, I think says, there's a risk that you're going to have this tax imposed against you. Mm-hmm. That would suggest that, yeah, you would lose, because there has to be a decision that changes things. And we would suggest, in fact, that the fact that the determination can be made by the Washtenaw based upon the language of the statute as opposed to going outside the statute suggests that the question of its ambiguity is somewhat doubtful. But nevertheless, The law says that, I mean, the whole idea of the law is that if somebody, if something changes that they could not have possibly taken account of, they will therefore be subject, they will be subject to the after imposed taxes clause and be able to take advantage of it. That's not what happened here. There were opportunities, many of them, to take advantage to otherwise resolve things. They didn't do it. A few minor things. We'll suggest, by the way, that the FAR clause actually does include state and local taxes. In the old days, in the case of Morrison Knudsen, for example, it did not include state and local taxes. The current FAR clause from which the AMS clause derives does include state and local taxes. It doesn't make any difference. There really isn't any good case law that addresses the kind of circumstances we are presented with here. What we do have is a little case law there is, shows that the law is read strictly. You look at what the law clause says, and even if you might have good reason to want to expand its interpretation, and Morpho certainly argues, hey, this is a case where, look, we didn't know. We shouldn't have to bear those costs.
Do you know if this after-imposed tax is routine with states?
I'm sorry, I misunderstand.
If other states have a tax like this?
I do not.
I'm sitting here thinking about impairment of contracts. You know, you all enter into this contract, and suddenly a taxing authority says you owe $5 million. So is this an ordinary tax, or do you know?
Well, we know that this tax has existed in Washington for 25 years.
Is it ordinary with other states? Do you know that? If you don't, that's fine.
The truth is, I don't know, Your Honor.
Okay.
Isn't there some tension between saying that contractors should try to avoid larding up their contracts with every conceivable contingency and saying, well, if it's ambiguous and it works out badly, that's your problem?
Well, I understand the concern, Your Honor, but there's a question of larding up with contingencies that are remote or impossible versus ones that, hey, this can be read two different ways. You've got a shot of having a big tax imposed on you and you should ignore it. Certainly, that's not what happened here. And in fact, we know that when Morpho had the opportunity to price out the installation, they included a contingency. They said, look, we didn't include the sales tax. They put it in there. We don't think it applies. They didn't think it applied, and in fact, it didn't apply. But nevertheless, they put it in there because they wanted to be careful. And there's no reason we can't be careful here. And of course, the after-imposed taxes clause does, even in its limited interpretation, or its limited scope, I should say, or proper interpretation, limited scope, does prevent the need for extra contingencies. You don't have to say, in case the state of Connecticut should impose a new tax that goes into effect afterwards, we want to be able to be ready for that. They don't have to say that anymore. They don't have to say, in case a lower court decision in the state of New Jersey gets overturned by the appeals court after we sign this contract, we're prepared for it. We don't have to do that anymore because the after-imposed taxes clause. It doesn't go as far as perhaps Morpho would like in preventing any need for contingency, but it certainly does make its step to avoiding that need.
Is it your position that they weren't careful here or that they were careful and tough luck?
There was no determination by ODRA whether or not Morpho was careful. Mm-hmm. What there was a determination of was that there was a law on the books for 25, 30 years that should have warned Morpho that there was a possibility of these taxes. And in those circumstances, they should be subject to the taxes without the government being required to reimburse them under the after-imposed taxes clause. And for those reasons, unless there are any further questions.
All right. Thank you.
We ask for sustain the decision of ODRA. Thank you.
Does Mr. Hillman have any time? All right. Why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. As I understand the government's position before the court at this point, it is that if a tax is ambiguous, it must be included in the contract, otherwise you're out of luck. That interpretation can't be squared with the clause itself that we're talking about, nor would it make any practical sense in terms of the virtues that that clause is supposed to support.
Well, it wouldn't be, I guess, the clause covers new taxes. And if it's on the books but ambiguous, it might apply to you, it might not. We'll see in the future in the state administrative process. I'm not sure it's a new tax when the state administrative or judicial determination comes out, yes, it does apply to you.
Well, the very notion that not just legislative action, but judicial and administrative action without limitation is included in this tax, I think shows that that interpretation can't be correct. The tax contemplates judicial rulings, which, as Your Honor says, frequently have the effect of taking an ambiguity and resolving it left or right, one way or the other. And further, the point of this clause in government contracting terms is to deal with the problem of contingencies. Contingencies are a term that's well understood in government contracts law. We quote the definition in the analogous CFR on page 12 of our reply brief. And those are defined broadly, presently known or unknown conditions, the effect of which cannot be measured to provide equitable results to the contractor or the government. We would say that where you have a tax, even one on the books for 25 years, that by our lights doesn't look like it would cover this at all, but I suppose has now in fact been read to do so, the government would not want, and in fact did not let us put contingencies into this contract to, you know, cover the eventuality that that might occur. This isn't just a clause to deal with, you know, on day one there's no tax, on day two a tax is enacted. It's intended to deal with the problem of ambiguity, of contingency, and that's exactly what we have.
You would negotiate, if you were advising a client tomorrow, you would say, let's put some more language in here.
Well, now the Washington taxes status is unambiguous.
Yeah.
No doubt about that.
I mean, there are 49 other places that are looking for money.
And as a practical matter, there's two other states that have this type of tax, Your Honor, to answer you, Hawaii and North Carolina. But as a practical matter, the government, as the authority we cite in our brief discusses, the government does not want us to include those contingencies. They don't want us coming to them and saying, we can build this for you for $100, but when you put in all the taxes that might or might not.
Well, it's part of the negotiation, right? But
well, that's right. And then there's
the risk.
And then there's two. Well, no, we're not, Your Honor. There's two ways that that negotiation gets resolved, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
One is you could price the contingencies in, which is generally disfavored under government contracting law.
Mm-hmm.
Or two, you can say, no, let's keep it bare.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not put those contingencies in, but let's put an after-imposed tax clause in. And then the question is, what type of eventuality rises to the level that should be considered worthy of recovering under the tax? And I think that up to this point, we've never heard that an ambiguous tax is one that we ought to be penalized for. Because again, it's incredibly unfair, not consistent with the clause, to say that a tax that hasn't had the benefit of being construed, but is ambiguous,
right,
is one that you're just out of luck for.
What happened in Washington State seems unfair. I'm not, that's, or potentially I shouldn't comment without knowing more about that, but anyway.
Well, we ask this court to reverse and remand because federal contracting law, which is what this court needs to is charged with looking at, is supposed to prevent this type of result. Thank you very much.
Thank you.